This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Colin Willoughby has served as Wake County District Attorney for 27 years. And nearly three decades as DA is a lot in any county, but being district attorney in the state capital adds even more pressure to the job. Colin has prosecuted everything from high-profile murder cases to civil disobedience to corruption in state government. And this year, he announced he will not run for re-election. Colin Willoughby joins us on the State of Things today to reflect on his 27 years in office. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for inviting me over.
So tell us how you fell into this job.
A series of coincidences. I was practicing law in the early 80s, and the district attorney took a temporary leave of absence, and the governor appointed me to fill in for a few weeks, and I enjoyed it, and so I ran for the job in 86 and got elected and been there ever since.
That was Governor Hunt.
That was.
What was it that you thought that office was? I mean, it was something that you hadn't run for up to then, so clearly it was not an aspiration, or was it? Was it something you'd wanted to do?
No, I had started practicing law, and my practice had sort of evolved to criminal practice, and being the district attorney and being in the district attorney's office, you got to try the most exciting cases and got to select not just the people that came to see you, but all the cases came to see you. And so it was an exciting thing to do, and I was intrigued by it and very interested and wanted to do it and got elected.
So tell us about Wake County in that time and the DA's, the job of being a district attorney back then.
Well, the county has nearly tripled in size since the mid-80s. It's now about 950,000 people, and it was less than 400,000 back then. So it's the county has grown, the office has grown, the court system has grown. Lots of things have come about, crimes that we didn't have. The internet's developed. We've become more sophisticated with a lot of identity theft and fraud and things like that didn't exist back then. So we've had to adapt and change with the times.
Good old-fashioned street crime probably hasn't changed in nature, but certainly in the amount of crimes that you saw.
It isn't. The emotions of greed and lust and substance abuse that have always kept us in business are there, but we also have a lot of other things that have come about, more sophisticated criminal theft processes and embezzlements and frauds that are much more sophisticated now than they were 30 years ago.
It's always a question I have for anybody in your job, a prosecutor's office, or for the police who work so hard to keep our streets safe. When your job is to come in contact with, people who do the worst and who express their seven deadly sins so frequently and so pointedly, what does it do to you and to your sense of human nature? Or is it an occupational hazard? And do you have to do something very consciously to keep from becoming an utter cynic?
Well, I think you probably do. And I think many of us compartmentalize our lives. We try to have a work life and a family life and keep some boundaries between them. If you don't, those things bleed over and you start getting a little too grouchy and crotchety. And so you try to keep those things in little compartments so you can walk away from it at night.
I mean, do you have to do anything special? What do you do to keep that stuff where it belongs?
I don't know. I think that's probably as much a function of personality and how you react to things. Some people, I don't think they don't handle it well, and it bleeds over. And for some of them, that's not their life's calling. What they need to get out and do something different. But I think the people that are there, it's sort of a survival mechanism that you keep the bad things at the office and try to have a normal life at home.
Now, I know you've only been Wake County prosecutor, so you don't have experience doing this job in another county, but you must have thought about whether it's more difficult to be in the state capital, where you might be prosecuting crimes of state corruption and other things, than being in another county, is it?
I think it's certainly more interesting, and we get a variety of things in Wake County that don't happen in other counties. We get the normal violent street crime and theft that everyone has, but we also get allegations of official misconduct and corruption, fraud, those things in state government, because we are the seat of state government. And so I think that that's made it very interesting and intriguing and sometimes a delicate balance to try to be careful that you do things in a way that keeps the public confidence and does not appear that you're favoring one side or the other.
Well, you and your office have successfully prosecuted state corruption charges against members of your own party in recent memory. What are the pressures on you?
I think that your pressures are more self-imposed. I think that there have not been the cases where some political leaders call you and say you shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do that. I think we've tried to take things and look at the facts and disregard the political part of it. And the more difficult thing is when it involves people that you know or that you've had some contact with and you realize that they've done things that they shouldn't have done, and trying to keep a balance so that you don't appear to be either being unduly harsh nor giving them some sort of favoritism. But it's just a kind of a delicate balance to walk.
Well, how do you do it? I mean, again, let's take a particular case. You prosecuted Jim Black. He was House Speaker. I mean, he literally took a bag full of money at some point. It was a federal case in the end, but you helped in the prosecution. It seems to me, let me just make this assertion, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that somebody doesn't have to make a phone call to a member of their party, the Democratic Party, to say, this is our leader in the House of Representatives. We're in the same party. I mean, we know all that. That's how parties are formed. The networks are there. You must feel it. And certainly people kind of buttonhole you. I mean, what are the mechanisms? What do you have to do to go forward in a case like that?
Well, I think the conduct in his case was so blatant that it in and of itself, folks didn't clamor around to support him and say, oh, he's just, you know, kind of fallen out of fellowship. This is not anything serious. And it was a joint matter between the federal authorities and ours. And he was prosecuted both in state court for the bribery as well as in federal court for some other charges. But in those cases, when the public becomes aware, the allegations come out that someone's taken cash in the bathroom at a restaurant from people with interest before the legislature, there was no public outcry or any private outcry to say, you know, you really shouldn't prosecute this person. The more difficult part, I think, is when you're in the investigatory stage and that information is not in the public domain. Most people think of this as some revered person, and they're wondering why you're conducting this investigation into a good person. Those are sort of the dark and lonely days. Once it gets to the prosecution, everyone looks at it and says, yes, this is bad. This needs to happen.
Jim Black was not the only government official that you've had to prosecute. In doing those, we talked about street crime and whether the impact on your sense of humanity. What about government itself, as you see these cases of corruption and you understand in detail how they take place and all of the relationships that are involved? Does it in any way diminish your confidence in government?
Well, I think we've had some unfortunate examples in the last 5 or 8 years of some officials at a high level that have been involved in criminal activity. But most of the functions of government are carried out at a much different level than that. They're carried out by career civil servants who come and do their work in transportation or health and human services or different areas of state government, and are very dedicated and achieve a lot of good results for on a very tight budget. So most of those things, you see the good of a lot of people, and people that come forward and say, we've seen something, this is not right, this is going on, we think someone ought to look into it. And it's sort of reassuring when you have a professional folks like that who are willing to step forward and say, something's not right in this, and it needs to be looked at by the authority.
From where you've been sitting in the past 3 decades, does anything need to change in terms of public policy to make government more transparent and to make it easier for people to come forward when they see things going on?
I think that our open records laws have allowed a lot more information to be out in the public domain. They've allowed the investigatory side of the news media to look at things, and that's where many of our cases have arisen from, investigative reporters that have delved into operations of government and found things that shouldn't be happening. But I don't think we particularly need a change from that regard. I'm a little bit concerned when I see movements of the legislature or the executive branch to make so many employees in subject to immediate dismissal. When they lose that protection, I think tends to silence criticism, and that's not always healthy in government. Sometimes we need healthy criticism.
Colin Willoughby is my guest, Wake County District Attorney, and we will continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Wake County District Attorney Colin Willoughby, who's decided not to run for re-election after 27 years as DA. He's joining us now to reflect on those decades, but tell us why you decided not to run again.
Well, I think in any walk of life, and particularly in government, I think you need to always be sensitive to when it's time to leave, and I think the office has been in good shape. We've got great professionals and staff there, and this just seemed like the right time to move out of the way and let the electoral process work itself and let the people select a new district attorney.
You recently, the Moral Mondays, of course, have been in the news. State Capitol has been getting a lot of attention. Your first recommendation to the folks making the arrest was just to issue citations, traffic tickets. Tell us more about that recommendation.
Well, I think they looked at me sort of like somebody's mother-in-law giving them advice. They didn't decide not to follow it. But, and I just thought that here's folks that are coming to publicly protest. They're not damaging property or harming anyone, that we ought to be sensitive in how we go about it and try to do things in such a way that if it is a violation of the law, there's a way to litigate that and make that determination, and that we handle things as professionally as we could otherwise. And I just didn't want it to be a train wreck of, that it sort of turned out to be with 1,000 people down coming to court.
Of course, your critics are saying those protesters were criticizing a party that is not yours, and you were soft on your friends.
Well, it's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. The porridge is either too hot or it's too cold. It's rarely ever just right. So one side thinks I'm being too harsh. The other thinks I'm being too lenient. And maybe they're both right.
You feel like you're right down the middle. Listen, in 2009, you lobbied against the Racial Justice Act. Tell us about that decision. Why?
I thought under our United States Supreme Court decisions that if there is discrimination, if you can show discrimination, that you have a right to have that verdict overturned. And the Racial Justice Act, which was, I think, very poorly drafted, set up a remedy that by simply showing a statistical correlation between race and outcomes made a basis to overturn those outcomes. And I think there ought to be some connection between that, not just the numbers. And I thought that was not the proper way to go about it, that folks ought to be able to come into court, and if they can show discrimination, they ought to get a redress for their grievance, but not simply by showing the numbers. I mean, if you look at the numbers generally, you find, unfortunately, homicides are much more significant. The numbers are black males commit a grossly disproportionate number of the homicides. In North Carolina, our death sentences had been fewer proportional on black males than on white males. And so I thought that the case for discrimination was there was no proof. There was simply statistics, and that was a poor way to make a legal decision.
Yeah, but here's one that since the death penalty was reinstated in 77, 77% of the victims of those homicides, of those who received the death penalty, 77% of them had white victims. So if you have a disproportionate number of black victims or even kind of 50-50, but most of the people that get the death penalty killed a white person, doesn't it give you pause? Doesn't it make you think, well, wait a minute, there's got to be something I should at least examine in this system before I go ahead with one more execution?
Well, Frank, I think that if you look at North Carolina's death penalty law, what you see is that we have 11 aggravating circumstances that define when the death penalty, a person is eligible for that. And the vast majority of homicides wind up being committed where black males are committing the homicide and black males are the victims. And what this Racial Justice Act did not take into consideration was the circumstances. I mean, if you have two black males on the street dealing drugs and one of them kills the other one, there's nothing that makes that homicide death eligible. It's not necessarily a capital case because of that. If someone goes in and kills a white convenience store clerk during the course of the robbery, that's pecuniary gain or committed during the course of a robbery is an aggravating circumstance. So I think what we did was we had this public relations campaign to say this is grossly unfair because of the race of the victim, but we didn't look at the conduct. We didn't look at whether or not these cases were death eligible. We simply looked at the race, and that's not, under our law, wasn't sufficient in order to show a causation.
Do you think that we should still have the death penalty?
I think that's a legislative decision. That's a policy decision. As a district attorney, I feel like it's my responsibility to try to carry out the laws that the General Assembly passes. Capital punishment is the law of the land, and we have tried to very selectively choose those cases that we thought were particularly heinous and terrible cases that met the criteria. I think that from our criminal justice system, we spend a grossly disproportionate amount of money prosecuting death penalty cases than we do prosecuting other cases. And in most homicide cases, I think the penalty of life without parole is a adequate punishment, and I think the public feels like that's an adequate punishment. I think there are a few cases in which are so atrocious that maybe we ought to have a penalty to deal with those, but it's a small group of cases that I think ought to be subjected to that.
Well, even when the crime is, as you say, a heinous crime that repulses all of us, the number of exonerations and the growing number of exonerations, doesn't that give you pause about ever issuing the ultimate sentence that cannot be revoked, not because the crime wasn't horrible, but because we just might not be right in our conviction?
Well, I think our cases now, we're much more sophisticated in our investigatory procedures, the science that we have, and we do have some exonerations in cases, and I'm glad that we do. If there's anyone who gets convicted who is not responsible for the crime, then we ought to do that. But I think we've got a very good criminal justice system in North Carolina. I think we have good remedies for reviewing these cases. The average length of stay on death row to execution had been about 9 or 10 years before execution, and I think that was plenty of time for multiple courts to go through with a fine-tooth comb and see if there's any flaw in this case. And if there is, send this case back and let's go back and relook at it. And I think we've got a good system to make that review, and I think those exonerations show the system is working.
When Gregory Taylor was up for retrial and was finally exonerated, you really made an effort to keep him in jail.
I made an effort to represent the state of North Carolina. The evidence in his case, there were five or six people who had told the police that they saw this woman get in a white SUV with him and Johnny Beck. And two or three hours later, she's found dead 300 yards from where their car is bogged down in a deserted area. And those circumstances were very compelling. You know, he didn't testify when his case came up in his trial. And, you know, had he testified, had he had presented other information, the jury might have exonerated him in the early 90s. But in this case, I felt like that the evidence was, it was a circumstantial case of evidence as to who committed this crime. And I thought that the state and that the victim deserved that evidence to be put forward, and I did that.
Well, criticism is because it was a circumstantial case, there wasn't much material evidence. And when evidence began to weigh against some of those circumstantial, some of the witnesses, and maybe this gets to a larger question of the job of prosecutor. You know, I'm sure you're about to say that it's about justice, but you have to win, and you get rated and scored on the wins. Do you get to a point in every case where, look, we got enough, let's just prosecute, let's just win?
Well, I don't think it's about winning. And if you look at the cases, our office and every prosecutor's office dismisses lots of cases every year where we make the decision that this case shouldn't go forward for whatever, either factual reasons or we look at the case and say, even though there may be a technical violation, it really shouldn't go forward for humanitarian reasons. And I think that that's important, and we do that. When we do find evidence and we think that the evidence points to guilt, then we prosecute those cases vigorously, and that's what I think the public expects of us to do. We try to do it in a fair way, but I mean, you know, you can't back off of a case because someone doesn't like it. I mean, that's why we have juries. We present that evidence to them. The juries make those kind of decisions, and you know, that's why you have prosecutors. I think you need prosecutors in which you have confidence that are doing things the right way and for the right reasons. But, you know, prosecutors aren't perfect either. We make mistakes sometimes.
You've been doing this job a long time, 27 years. That's plenty of time to find something wrong. And one of the things that you find uniformly in doing the research about you and your career is how many people who've been on both sides of the aisle in the courtroom have talked about your integrity and the way you've conducted yourself in that office. And given the pressure, that's quite a statement. You also talked about the fact that our science and criminal prosecution is getting better, but the SBI at one point was really under the spotlight, and there was a lot wrong with the SBI. Are you convinced that things are better and they're on the right track right now?
Oh, I think things are much better, but you know, we still have severe budget limitations. We have lengthy delays. I mean, if you send cases to the SBI now, it may take 6 or 9 months to get results back. You know, the results that come back may exonerate someone, just like they may convict that person. And, you know, is it fair for someone to be held in custody for 9 months while we wait on those tests? Those are hard questions. And I think our policy leaders need to look at the state crime lab, and it needs to be adequately funded that we can get this results quickly, that we can get them in results that we have confidence in, and these cases can move along quickly, that people don't get held in jail if they're not guilty. And I think that's a huge downside of what doing this on the cheap, and I think that's what's happened, that this particular branch of government has not been adequately funded. In Wake County, our county commissioners have put together a lab to do drug testing because we can get them back in 30 days instead of 6 months. They do testing for blood alcohol and blood drugs for impaired driving because we can get those back in 30 or 45 days instead of waiting 9 months in the state lab. But they have recognized that the services at the state level are inadequate for what the people of Wake County expect, and they've met it. And I really think the state leaders need to step up and return a better service. And it's going to take more chemists. I mean, we would like to be able to do DNA in lots of cases now that we just economically can't afford to do it.
You have been important, I guess, since your time as DA in Wake County. That county has expanded the drug treatment courts. I think you've been part of that. Tell us about that and the importance of it.
I think drug treatment courts are a very good part of our system. I think it deals with some people who have addictions, and that it's cost effective to keep these people out and keep them working and paying taxes instead of having them in state institutions. I think we need to expand that concept. In fact, we've solicited from the National Department of Transportation to do some DWI treatment courts that work in conjunction with trial courts so that we can get hardcore alcoholics the kinds of treatment that they need to keep them off the highway. But I think that's a viable and cost-effective way of dealing with some of the cases.
And you've really had, again, a lot of time to watch cases of people with mental illness and substance abuse come through the court system. You've reflected on it, and I know you've talked about it, and you're critical in the way that our criminal justice system is having to deal with cases that might be better dealt with elsewhere.
I have been critical. I think one of our tremendous shortcomings in the society is that we have not dealt with mental illness in a way we should. The courts have become the de facto institutionalization for for many people who are mentally ill. They wind up committing usually lesser serious crimes. They get arrested. We get processed. We get them medicine. We get them stabilized, and we put them back on the street, and they revolve back through our system over and over again. It's a very expensive and inhumane way of dealing with it. I think we as a society really need to come to grips. Part of it arises, I think, out of the trend in the 70s to close institutions, deinstitutionalize, put people in the least restrictive care, put them on the street. Some of these folks really can't function without some structure, and we need to look at the way we deal with mental health, and we shouldn't dump it on the court system.
It's well, and part of the reason that deinstitutionalization broke down is because the money was supposed to follow the patient and never did. And so as you talk about cuts to SBI, cuts to the DA's office, we're also cutting education, and there's a strong correlation between education and crime. We know the less education you have, the more likely you are to commit a crime. So you're cutting funding for law enforcement, you're cutting money for education and mental health services in this state. That sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Well, it worries lots of us in the law enforcement and in the prosecution field. If you surveyed district attorneys around the state, I think many of them would tell you that, you know, money spent in early intervention, early childhood intervention, education at the lower level, assistance to young mothers with infants. I mean, lots of those things would probably have long-term implications on crime, but those are decisions that get made in the policy level on the legislative side, and you know, that's why we elect people to do that. We don't get to make those decisions. Well, we just have to deal with the fallout.
Well, you do, and because you're dealing with the fallout, we'd hope that they talk with you before they make their decisions, because you probably have some insight into who you see and what could have been done to prevent this.
I don't think they really they don't solicit our advice about those kind of things there. You know, but I think most of us in the prosecution field see the high correlation between education and crime, between substance abuse and crime. And I think both substance abuse and mental health are things that have not gotten an overall comprehensive system of addressing them that we need to. I think that both of them would have significant implications on reducing crime if we used a coordinated system of addressing them.
All right, you're stepping down after nearly three decades. Who do you want to replace you?
Somebody who really wants the job and who's will carry it on and wants to work hard at it. That there are a number of good candidates who are out there, and the public will get to select who they think is best suited.
Ready to endorse any of them?
I don't think so. I think that I think I should step back and let the process go forward.
Any advice for your successor, whoever that may be?
I try to be sensitive to your family. Realize that this impacts them. It'll take you hours away from your wife or children or husband, whatever it is, and you know, try not to let the things overpower you and get carried away with the job and let it consume you.
What are you going to do now?
I hope to go back to work practicing law and maybe do something that's just not in the spotlight. Maybe help do some business work. Maybe help some businesses who are facing investigations and need someone to guide them through that.
Colin Willoughby, thank you so much. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Frank.
Colin Willoughby is Wake County District Attorney. Coming up next, music and poetry to explore Jewish faith. Stay with us on The State of Things.